listener production.
Hi, Sasha Barbagat with you for another episode of The Briefing. It has been a devastating weekend for Sydney siders and Australians everywhere. The brutal and sudden loss of life in a place that is so ordinary and familiar has been shocking and gut-wrenching. From everyone at The Briefing, we send our condolences and thoughts to all those affected by the Bondi Junction attack. We'll be talking about the latest updates in the headlines today, and we'll also be releasing a special episode. Check back at 7 a.m. to listen. In this episode, we are bringing you part three of our four-part series on sex work in Australia in 2024. That's coming up after the headlines. First, though, here's Bension Siebert. It's Monday, April 15.
Well, Australian flags across the country will be flown at half-mast today, while overnight monuments in Melbourne have been lit up in white to honour the victims of the stabbing massacre at Bondi Junction over the weekend. It comes 2 days after the shocking attack, during which a man killed six people while inside a Westfield shopping centre in Sydney's east. The man responsible has been identified as 40-year-old Joel Couchy, who was shot dead by police at the scene. Five victims have so far been named. They include 38-year-old mother Ashley Good, 25-year-old Dawn Singleton, 47-year-old Jade Young, 30-year-old Faraz Ahmed Tahir, and 55-year-old Pikria Dashia from Georgia.
A floral tribute's been growing outside the shopping centre. All throughout yesterday and into last night, people were visiting the scene to pay their respects. And this was not only to the victims, but also for the brave bystanders who tried to confront Couchy. A number of onlookers used bollards and random shopping centre objects as makeshift weapons to try to stop him. And images and footage of that action is going viral at the moment. One of those people who did grab something and try to help was Silas Depro. Here's what he told Channel 7.
I'm not going to lie, I was scared. But you cannot just stay away and not do anything.
Others also helped police in their search for the 40-year-old. And as I mentioned at the top, we will have more on the Bondi Junction murders in a special episode coming out at 7 a.m. Check back in your feed later this morning.
After 14 months of hearings, Bruce Lerman will finally hear the verdict in his defamation case against Network 10 and broadcaster Lisa Wilkinson. Justice Michael Lee will reveal his judgment in the federal court today, 2 weeks after it was originally supposed to drop. The case was dramatically reopened at the start of the month to allow for fresh evidence from a Seven News producer. The verdict and analysis will be in our afternoon briefing later today.
Israel's war cabinet has been given authority to respond to an unprecedented strike launched by Iran, but what that will look like is yet to be decided. Iran launched more than 300 missiles and drones at Israeli territory over the weekend, almost all of which were intercepted, according to authorities.
Now, this represents a major escalation in the long-running shadow war between the two nations, and it's a response to Israel's strike on Iran's consulate in Syria last week, which killed 13 people. World leaders are urging Israel to show restraint, but the country's war cabinet minister has pledged to, quote, exact a price. And Iran, in turn, has vowed any retaliation will be met with a stronger response.
Yeah, it's definitely sparking kind of talk of a potential for more of an all-out war in the Middle East, Bension. But back home, it is worth mentioning that there will be pro-Palestine protests around the country today. Now, these are supposed to be quite devastating to the economy. That is what the group that is behind organising them is saying. In a quote, in participating cities, they'll block the arteries of capitalism and jam the wheels of production. So the cities that are listed to be included are Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, Hobart, Darwin and Canberra, as well as Geelong, Alice Springs and Castlemaine. So whether they end up being as big as promised is yet to be seen, but worth a mention here that they could potentially escalate.
And Joe Biden and Donald Trump are being urged to participate in a televised debate by a bunch of US networks. Neither has so far engaged in a debate with members of their own party, which is usually a key feature in the race for nomination. 12 news organisations, including Fox, CNN, NPR and the Associated Press, have put out a statement saying the stakes of this election are exceptionally high and there is simply no substitute for the candidates debating with each other and before the American people their visions for the future of our nation.
We'll have to wait and see if the presidential nominees adhere to their request, Bensyon. I personally enjoy a presidential debate. I'm a bit of a voyeur in that way. I like that it doesn't affect me directly and I get to watch them go at each other on TV.
Yeah, it's lots of fun. We should also mention that this week also marks the start of Trump's first criminal trial. This is the one in Manhattan over the alleged hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels. These charges carry up to 4 years in prison. The American Constitution doesn't necessarily bar a felon or even someone in prison from being president, but Trump won't be able to pardon himself from this one because it's a Manhattan trial, but he will likely get a relatively hostile jury because it's a very Democratic-leaning area.
Interesting. We'll have to wait and see how that one plays out. Bensyon, thanks for being here for the headlines. Look, as I mentioned, we will be releasing a special episode on the Bondi Junction attack a little bit later this morning. First, though, let's get into episode 3 of our 4-part series looking at sex work in Australia in 2024.
In recent years, it seems the shame and stigma around sex work has, at least to some degree, kind of evaporated. This cultural shift may not be evenly distributed across the country or across generations, but with decriminalisation in some states, the rise of OnlyFans in influencer culture since COVID, and less derogatory language becoming mainstream, you don't hear it called prostitution much anymore, there has absolutely been a change. But people are still getting sacked from their day jobs when their boss finds out they do sex work on the side. In Victoria, which decriminalised sex work in 2022, it's technically illegal in many circumstances for a boss to fire you for doing OnlyFans or any other kind of lawful work. But the law is different in every state, and even when the law is on your side, very few people are willing to go through a tribunal process or a court to defend those rights. Animal Justice MP Georgie Purcell secretly worked as a stripper during her law degree at a time when a lot of that cultural and legal change hadn't happened yet. She's now one of this country's most prominent, proud advocates for sex workers' rights, and her story tells us a lot about where we've come to in Australia in 2024. Georgie, thanks for joining us on The Briefing. You're now an MP and a prominent advocate for the rights of sex workers, but there was a time in your life when sex work was something you needed to hide. Where does that story start for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started stripping when I was at university and I did the very best I could to keep it from my peers. In fact, one person knew who was my best friend and she was actually doing it with me. Mm-hmm. And it was such a private thing to me. And looking back on that time now, I think the conversation when it comes to sex work has really shifted in the last decade. That was in 2011 that I was doing that.
What were you studying?
I was studying law. Mm-hmm. And I guess long story short is someone found out, took photos of me, and I got outed in a really big way at my campus, but also online. And, you know, those photos still exist to this day. That's the danger of, you know, doing this to people. It lives on forever and, you know, it can continue to re-traumatise you. But everybody found out about it and I was afraid that I couldn't become a lawyer because I really convinced myself that I wouldn't be deemed a fit and proper person as you have to pass that test. And it held me back for a really, really long time, really only until recently. And I decided to own that story when I went into politics.
There's kind of the obvious, but what was it about that at that time that you felt you absolutely had to keep it secret?
I think being a sex worker then or involved in, you know, the adult industry in any way was still really stigmatized. And it, of course, still is now, but there's been a big change recently, I think, particularly with decriminalization laws coming in across the country and people having more understanding of, you know, who is a sex worker and what is a sex worker. I always say, whether you know it or not, someone you love is or was a sex worker. But the reality is most of us keep it a secret. And many of us keep it a secret for a very long time, just like I did. I still, of course, receive criticism. I'm a politician, you know, with like a relatively big profile, and people absolutely try and use it against me. And that's part of the reason why I own the story. It's actually kind of disappointing that I had to, because I knew that if I wasn't public and open about it, someone else would be for me.
Where do you think we are at culturally with that conversation? Because advocates have been saying for a really long time, sex work is real work.
I think that there's been a fundamental shift in recent years with the rise of digital platforms and things like OnlyFans, of course, which, you know, rose up during the pandemic. And that went from like an influencer inside their lives platform to a outlet for sex workers when they had no other option when we're in lockdown. I think that it's becoming more accepted and more normalised, but there's still this huge amount of, I think, shame surrounding it. Mm-hmm. What always amazes me is that criticism and that shaming most often comes from the people who consume it. And I often reflect on the fact that I got outed as a stripper and someone thought that was an awful thing about me, but someone had to be present there.
Someone had to be
consuming
there to take the
what
photo.
I was putting out. And, you know, it happened to a friend of mine who was doing porn and she got outed in her workplace. And we don't step back and think, well, someone had to be looking for that porn to discover that she was doing it.
Yeah.
So I think it is starting to change. And I think that when I look back at what happened to me, I was completely left alone. Like I've been very open about my journey with it. I got diagnosed with PTSD. I was suicidal. Basically everyone surrounding me abandoned me except for my best friend. And I don't think that would happen now. I think if what happened to me in 2011 happened in 2024, the criticism would be on the person that did it to me. And that gives me a lot of hope.
All that said, and there is obviously a lot of stigma around sex work, there are also workplaces where sex work is kind of anathema or is seen as anathema to the ethos of the place, like people who work with children, people who do funeral directing, some people might feel nervous about someone who does sex work also doing medical procedures on them for various stigmatizing reasons. What would you say to people who feel that there are workplaces where sex work is not appropriate as like a side hustle?
I would say that sex work is a form of labor where we use our bodies. And nobody gets criticised when they use their body for labour in another way. We're not concerned about construction workers that might be, you know, going off to do other jobs or, you know, artists or performers. And it's this ongoing over-sexualisation of people who do that when the reality is if you get to know us, that's absolutely, you know, not the case at all. In fact, you sit down and talk to a sex worker and they'll tell you, have a lot of funny stories to tell you about the things they experienced in the job. I think it's this idea that we are, you know, these sexual deviants who are, you know, can't be trusted when it's, you know, absolutely not the case.
Do you see a future where other MPs, judges, police officers, people in really prominent positions are doing sex work on the side and doing that openly or have done in the past and it's completely open?
I hope so. I'd like to say I hope so. And that's absolutely part of the reason why I'm very open about who I am, because I knew that when I got elected that I was going to be remarkably different to the average politician just by my age and, you know, how I look, have a body covered in tattoos. And there was something else about me that I knew actually a lot of people would be able to relate to. And we always say, you know, you can't be what you can't see. And I felt an obligation to be honest about who I was and very authentic about my past. And I think as more and more people do that, when it's safe and comfortable for them to do so, we will see this shift in acceptance. I actually had an idea, which I'm not going to deploy. I've never spoken about this before, about starting an OnlyFans as a member of parliament to be like, hey, look, I can do both and there's no shame in it. And just on what you said, there are so many people, especially, you know, in a cost of living crisis, it's harder than ever before for many people where they are turning to sex work in secret outside of their usual jobs in order to, you know, live and make ends meet. And we need to, I think, move towards a space where we're accepting and okay with that, if that's what they feel comfortable doing.
We have seen examples even in Victoria where the anti-discrimination legislation is quite strong and sex work has been decriminalised, where people have been sacked for doing OnlyFans on the side. How much say do you think a boss should have in our online lives? Because it's not only sex work, it's also, you know, people who've tweeted things that people have been offended by or whatever. Where should an employer sit in that conversation?
Yeah. It's a great question and one that I often reflect on a lot as more and more young people enter politics, like myself. So there's soon going to be no MPs that don't have a digital footprint, right? The older generations, they got to do the silly things and survive it without anyone knowing about it. I think that there's a big difference between doing something that is problematic and harmful and could create an unsafe working environment for other people in the workplace compared to someone having autonomy over their own body and doing something that they want to do freely and feel safe doing. And, you know, when it comes to sex work, if you're doing that as well as another job, I personally think it's actually none of your boss's business. But, you know, we're not quite there yet.
The other, I guess, stigma around sex work is its relation with sex trafficking and non-consensual sex work and that kind of thing. There are a lot of people who might be out there saying, if you're doing sex work, then there's something seriously wrong or you're in danger of in some kind of way.
Yeah, it's a very nuanced conversation, and that's why decriminalisation is absolutely the correct approach, because as long as this industry is operating underground without licensing, without regulation, it allows things like that to go on. Sex workers will do the work at a time in their lives where they might be struggling or need it for survival, but many people do other jobs for the same reason. And as long as they're doing it their own free will and safely, then there is no issue with it in my mind. But it's why we need to move towards a model that is legal and safe and regulated, just like we've recently done in Victoria and other states are moving to do, to protect the people who actually are in it without their consent and without their choice, because I fully acknowledge that can be the case.
Should someone who does sex work tell their employer that they do it?
No. I think that making that decision is a very personal one, and it can take a long time to accept and be comfortable with in your own mind. It took me 10 years to be open about telling other people, but I was fully comfortable in my own world and my own space doing it myself. The other thing with sex work is you put on a different persona. You go to work and become a different person. You have a different name. You have a different personality. And there's safety and comfort between the two worlds. There are far too many people who are losing their friendships and families and relationships as a result of their association with sex work. And it can flow on to employment if you tell your boss. And I think as long as it's being done legally and safely, it's actually nobody's business but the person doing it and the people that they're doing it with.
They shouldn't feel pressured.
Yes.
Finally, in Victoria, as we mentioned, there's anti-discrimination laws. Sex work has been decriminalised. It is not lawful for an employer to discriminate against someone for also doing sex work, but it has happened. Do you think that there needs to be further law change in order to change that situation? Or do you think that this is simply a cultural issue?
Yeah, look, I think that the best laws don't work unless there's education around them. And I think that's fundamentally what's missing here. We did decriminalise sex work, and the sex work community was very aware of that. They were very involved. They were very engaged. But there probably wasn't enough work done to inform employers of their obligations and the new rules. I think that the other thing is that we can't just implement a law and not do the things to see it through to make it as effective as possible. And right now I'm working with a number of the sex worker advocacy orgs and their, you know, union equivalent on funding and education pieces for this very reason, because there are still so many out there who don't understand the rules that they now need to operate under, and that includes employers.
If there's someone listening to this podcast right now and they're working an office job or they're studying in some venerable institution and also doing sex work secretly on the side, what would be your message to that person?
My message to that person would be there is no shame in what you're doing. In fact, I'm at the point now where I'm actually very proud of my past. I took control of what happened to me and my story in order to have power in the future. And I think that as more and more of us do that, we become a very, very powerful force, and we will be able to change the narrative around the oldest job in history. It's the oldest profession to ever exist, but it's still so highly stigmatized. And anyone who is doing it has absolutely nothing to be ashamed of. The only people that do are the ones that criticize it.
Georgie Purcell, thanks so much for joining us on The Briefing.
Thank you for having me.
Georgie Purcell there. If this episode raised any issues for you, help is available. You can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. That's it for The Briefing this morning. Check your feed again at 3 for everything you need to know about the massive defamation case involving Bruce Lerman. And tomorrow morning, we'll bring you the final episode of our four-part series on sex work in 2024. In the meantime, we'd love it if you shared this episode or another one that you enjoyed with a friend or a family member. We'd really appreciate it. I'm Bension Siebert. Thanks for listening. Listener.